This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. So it'll be Borussia Dortmund versus PSG in the first Champions League semi-final. Barca were two up on aggregate when Ronald Araujo decided to stop Barcola running through a straight red, and that changed the game. Dembele scoring against his former club, Cancelo giving away a needless penalty, and Mbappe doing the rest. What is this vaguely sensible PSG and when will it stop? It's the first time in 25 games that a side who lost the first leg at home has progressed in the Champions League. Dortmund were also behind and ahead, then behind again before the yellow wall sucked in Nicholas Füllkrug's brilliant header and Marcel Sabitzer rifled one home. A stunning achievement for a side who weren't even fancied to get out of the group. Also today, Cole Palmer beats Everton 6-0. A perfect hat-trick and a fourth from the sport after he was allowed to take it by his teammates. Congratulations are in order for Portsmouth, who are back in the Championship while Forest Green are relegated from League 2. We'll ask Archie the secret to talking to footballers. There's an apology to Roy Hodgson, a bit of Coronation Street at Manchester United, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hiya.
Hello, Jonathan Faduba.
Good morning.
And he doesn't dress up for us. I mean, he does get dressed, to be clear. It's Archie Rintat, welcome.
I offered the pink jacket. It was declined.
Yeah. Fair enough. You may dress however you feel. That will get to the fact that you are the most popular man in football right now, Archie. I'm amazed you've lowered yourself to talk to us, but we appreciate it greatly. Let's start with Barca PSG. PSG winning 4-1, 6-4 on aggregate. As I said in the intro, first time in 25 games that a side who lost after the first leg at home went away from home and won. And we think that was Spurs beating Ajax in 2019. PSG had lost seven ties when they'd lost the first leg. So, Barry, this is quite some achievement for them.
I think their greatest achievement is the fact that I find them quite a likeable team. And, yeah, it was an impressive achievement. Otherwise, this was a wild, chaotic, white knuckle ride of a game, full of brilliance, some terrible mistakes. And I think the red card obviously changed the game. I don't think it necessarily cost Barcelona the game. They had chances before PSG put it to bed. Gundogan, Rafinha, Lewandowski all had good chances when it was 3-1 and there was only a goal in it on aggregate. And I think ultimately Barcelona sort of panicked following the lead of their manager, who had a total meltdown on the sideline, which I thought was... He didn't comport himself very well last night. I don't watch enough Spanish football to know if this is normal behaviour for him, for Xavi, but he, if his team man down or looking for guidance from the touchline, they weren't getting any because his head just went. But it was a terrific game with some calamitous errors in it. The red for Araujo, Cancelo giving away that utterly needless penalty. But I really, really enjoyed it, and I find it weird that I wish this PSG team... I'm not going to say I wish them well, but I find them reasonably likeable, unlike previous incarnations.
Yeah, Lars said, look, PSG deciding to start building an actual team rather than just throw money at random famous people is a huge blow to the banterverse. And Robin saying the same thing as you. Can we get the old banter era PSG back? These group of players are easy to like and it doesn't sit right with anybody. I wonder, Jonathan, I'm not defending Araujo for that challenge, but it must take a lot of... In that moment, you can see why a defender just wants to stop the attacker going through, but it's, they're two up. At that time in the tie, they are two up, Barcelona. Just shepherd Barcola towards the goal. I mean, that is a better thing to do.
Yeah, I saw Rio Ferdinand's analysis of it, which, I think as a defender, there's been a lot of talk about pundits in the last week or so. But I thought he actually made a fair point in that sense and gave it the perspective of a defender. And maybe his job was to sort of run back to the penalty area, get into a position where he can kind of block the attacker and then take it from there, essentially, instead of fly in, go in a 1v1 race and kind of charge in just like a bull and thinking you're going to make it and then not make it. So, it was a little bit kind of unnecessary, I think. Obviously, from the Barcelona perspective, a lot of the talk at the moment is about the referee. Xavi kind of called the referee a scandal. I think the media in Barcelona called it a disgrace. And there's a lot of talk at the moment about the referee's influence on that match. And he did make one or two sort of strange and interesting decisions. I mean, personally, I want to talk about Dembele. I thought that it was Dembele's renaissance, if you could call it that, or it was the reminder that he's actually a good player over the years. And I think if there's one player you don't want to wind up, it's definitely Ousmane Dembele. He seemed really keen in this game. I had a feeling from the beginning that he was going to show up. He was booed. There was a lot of talk in the Paris media about the reception that basically Dembele and Mbappe were going to face from the Barcelona fans. Obviously, with a controversial move to PSG from Dembele from Barcelona. And he really was not liked in the sort of last year or so of his time there and the round of departure. So, yeah, he put in a fantastic performance, a good goal again. And, obviously won the penalty from Cancelo, which was another crazy decision, Maxi, in terms of how, you know, flying in really quite needlessly, really Cancelo there when they were up against it. But yeah, Dembele is not someone you want to really upset over his career. He doesn't score a huge amount of goals, but 2016 for Rennes, he got a hat-trick in the Breton derby against Nantes, which is like the biggest game basically for Rennes. He scored the winner in the German Cup semi-final when he was at Dortmund for Dortmund against Bayern Munich. I think it's 2017 in the German Cup semi-final. And if you see the grin on his face at the end of the match, it was the sort of serious kind of cheesy grin at the end of it to cap off a performance that I think he really personally would have enjoyed. But like Barry said, I really enjoyed PSG's performance. Barcola was quality as well. Mbappe, you knew he was going to have an influence at some point, and it was just a thoroughly enjoyable game, I thought. And although the red card did change it, it didn't sort of, because of the lead that Barcelona had at that point, it still was a compelling match, if that makes sense. So it didn't end the game if it was.
Yeah.
They still had a lot to do.
Yeah. I wonder if, I don't know what you think, Archie. I know you were mainly focused on the other game, but like, do you think taking Lamine Yamal off was a mistake? Like, hindsight is a wonderful thing, but he was causing so many problems. And obviously you have to tinker when you go down to 10 men, but I just wondered if that was a silly thing for Xavi to do. I'm not quite as silly as kicking a big cushion. It suggests if there is a big cushion, they've placed it there because they know he's going to kick things. But more importantly, like, Yamal was playing so well, like, find another solution.
When you look at the strength of Xavi's response post-game, talking about the referee, I often think that these are people who are suppressing the fact that they know it was their fault in some way, that they did things that they would like to take back. And I think one of those things is probably Yamal's substitution. If you wanted a more honest appraisal of the mistakes that were made by Barcelona, it was worth looking towards Ilkay Gundogan's interview, where he was saying, I need to see it again, but at the same time, making sure that Ronald Araujo knew that he didn't need to make that challenge because, as Gundogan said, well, if he doesn't do that, you know, we're not down to 10 men. And I think that, it's the sort of honesty that needs to be had at Barcelona with this situation. As for PSG and Dembele, the fact he's been taking a lot of heat in France because of only scoring one goal in Ligue 1 so far this season, only one more technically than Neymar has for the club this season, and he's not there anymore. So Kylian Mbappe has also faced a lot of heat about being a dictator. A very good friend of mine is French and a PSG fan, and has sent me this video that was made on Twitter of Kylian Mbappe as Mao Zedong because of how L'Equipe published a long article after the first leg about Neymar and how his behaviour at PSG was bad, as if to take the spotlight away from Kylian Mbappe.
Right, okay.
He's turned up, and it shows you what Lars was saying last week and what he said there. I really liked the line about them not being a guest list anymore, albeit it did make me think of, oh, if you were building teams as a guest list, who would it be? But I think it shows you how you need to, you can't, you do have need to have an obvious star, probably in one row of the formation at max. But if you start to have more than that, then people are going to start getting in each other's way. And yeah, Luis Enrique has found the balance.
I don't think we mentioned him last week and he was brilliant. And we haven't mentioned him yet today.
Can I guess?
And he was brilliant again.
Vitinha?
Yes.
Yeah, amazing.
What a player.
Yeah.
He just covers so much ground. He's so good. He dictates the play in midfielder and seemingly just does it all under the radar because you don't hear many people talking about him. But I thought he was absolutely class over the two legs.
I mean, actually, you could furnish us, Jonathan, with a bit more info about Vitinha. There will be some listeners who don't know his entire backstory. I don't know if you do.
I mean, he was at Wolves for a season, a couple of seasons ago.
Was he? Yeah. Blimey.
He's Portuguese, so, you know, the chances are it's a very...
You're right. Luis Figo was there for a bit, wasn't he? Yeah.
50-50 chance in the current, you know, in the Wolves history. But yeah, obviously, he's been at Porto, essentially. He had a season on loan at Wolves. I think it was during the COVID season, roughly 2020, 2021. So maybe that might be why not many people remember him. He made 22 appearances. Went back to Porto and then PSG picked him up in 2022. And he sort of, on his day, he's a good player. I think one thing with PSG and a lot of their players, is they haven't been incredible in Ligue 1. They're still that... have that propensity to kind of let people down on the day at times. But one thing I feel with Luis Enrique, he's just sharpened that kind of focus in the Champions League. There was an element of kind of control and he seems to have sort of transmitted a style in Europe where there was a lot of belief. He had a lot of influence in his press conferences and what he was saying and kind of the way he sort of implemented this coaching style on the team. They just kept that calmness about them where when the red card happened, they didn't panic. They didn't, like, we've seen PSG so many times over the years in Champions League knockouts just start panicking no matter what the situation is. They could be ahead. There was a lot of talk about La Remontada and the kind of the comeback from 2017 and, you know, the whole Barca PSG history. And when they were 4-2 down, in previous seasons, you'd think to yourself, it's done, even with a red card almost. But Luis Enrique's kind of implemented a style where there's a lot of belief there. They're much better coached, I think. And they just had that maturity about them, which is very rare for a PSG team, really, which, as Barry alludes to. And I think there's got to be a special shout-out for Barcola as well. He's someone who essentially was Messi's replacement in a way. Not necessarily directly, but he was brought in last season, at the beginning of the season from Lyon, known about a lot in French football circles. He's a really good young talent and kind of a redirection of Paris Saint-Germain's transfer policy to kind of start to sign more players from France and forget, you know, getting over the whole Messi, Neymar sort of policy that they had in the past. And he's one of them that's come in and he had a really great influence on that game. I thought he had, you know, the cross for Dembele's goal and I thought he was really good. And it was a shame Lamar went off because he was having a good game. But I just was very impressed with Luis Enrique, how he dealt with both legs, to be fair. And although Xavi had a bit of a meltdown towards the end, I thought Luis Enrique kept his cool a little bit and honestly won the tie.
Given how much was being made of how this was a chance for PSG to do their own remontada, I was thinking, I'm sure they've got a better way of saying that in French. I've been told it's le comeback, so that'll be a no.
Oh, really good. Yeah, it was le comeback. Interesting with Barcelona, and Dan says, look, is the Barcelona era of tiki-taka now tainted by their complete ability to get it launched properly? Just watching, and like, Xavi's Barcelona are more direct, right, than we expect the Barcelona to be. There's this brilliant moment, Baz, just before half-time where obviously they're down to 10 men now and one Barcelona player just lumps it upfield and then another Barcelona player just wins a massive header. And I was like, I am here now for 45 minutes of shithousery, a sort of mixture of Stoke and Atletico Madrid. Seeing Barcelona kits do it was just like amazing, but it didn't quite pan out that way.
No, very, very Dave Besson to John Fashanu, wasn't it? The knockdown to Terry Gibson, who's obviously has forged a very good career for himself as a pundit covering Spanish football. But yeah, I mean, That Barcelona does not bear any resemblance whatsoever to the Barcelona that Xavi played in. And, you know, the things evolve. But they're very entertaining to watch, as were the other Barcelona. Not this Barcelona aren't quite as hypnotic.
That's true. John Beck was a very cultured footballer and then became, you know, dirty long ball hero. And so, you know, perhaps that's Xavi. That's what he really wants to do. You know, his next job, maybe his next job will be AFC Wimbledon. Jonathan?
The thing is, I think you do touch on a good point there, Max, because in terms of the crowd was very hostile. We talked about that towards Dembele and Mbappe. But I kind of felt that they lacked a bit of hostility on the pitch. They were still a bit sort of point in the game when I started thinking about Pepe and just like they lacked a kind of someone on the pitch to just be a bit nasty. And like Dembele is someone you can kind of wind up Dembele if you want. And although the crowd were winding him up as a professional, he dealt with that really well, but there wasn't really anyone on the pitch to sort of wind him up and get in his face. And I felt that was one element they lacked, a little bit of just maturity in key moments, like the Araujo moment, the Cancelo moment. If you look at the fourth goal as well, Mbappe's second goal, there's a moment where, like, when it's all sort of ricocheting in the box, there was a moment for Fermin, who's a young talent from Barcelona, to just hoof it clear, and he just sort of hesitated for a split second. If you watch it back, and that allows the chance to sort of fall to Mbappe, and I think he would have gone through someone else if he'd have launched that away, but he just sort of split second hesitated, maybe didn't want to boot someone else in the chest or whatever, and clear it as well. So there was just that little element of maybe shithousery that they lacked, whereas they had it off the pitch because Xavi was booting the camera and booting everything else off the pitch, wasn't he? That's why he got the red card. But just on the pitch, I felt they just lacked maybe that little bit of nastiness at times.
Just love the idea of someone walking into La Masia and going, "All right, change of plan, guys. 4-4-2. This is what we're doing. When the fullback get it, hit the channels from under sevens all the way up." Sid Lowe tweeting, "Some Barcelona fans threw things at their own bus. The massive club badge and Barca written on the side was a clue that it didn't spot. My guess, you know, if you are going to attack..."
And to be clear, this was before the game.
Before the game. Yeah. They weren't angry. They just didn't spot it. I suppose if that is a portent, you know, if you're gonna do that, then maybe it isn't going to be your day. All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do Dortmund's victory over Atleti. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Dortmund 4, Atleti 2, Dortmund winning 5-4 on aggregate. Matt saying, not a question, worth pointing out that the Dortmund-Atleti game had 6 goals and each goal changed which team was winning on aggregate. At the start it was Atleti. After each goal it was draw Dortmund, draw Atleti, draw Dortmund full time. Rob Daly tweeting, the potential semi-final lineups tonight with times, Central European Standard Time, 9 p.m. Barca-Atleti, 9:34 Barca versus Atleti or Dortmund, 9:39 Barca versus Dortmund, 10:08 Barca versus Atleti or Dortmund, 10:16 Barca or PSG versus Atleti or Borussia Dortmund, 10:23 PSG, Atleti or Dortmund, 10:24 PSG or Atleti, 10:30 PSG versus Atleti or Dortmund, and at 10:32 finally PSG versus Dortmund. You look bored, Barry.
Very.
I thought, listen, you've got to do it with conviction. Halfway through, I was like, I shouldn't have bothered, but I'd started. So I'll finish. And look, we go on and on about the yellow wall, Archie, but Coit looked good at the end there.
Understandably, that's their best European moment since they reached the Champions League final in 2013. And also because these Dortmund fans have not known what to do with themselves this season when it comes to how Dortmund will play. I am still very confused as to who and what they are, but the best explanation of them was provided to me by a man called Tilo on Twitter, who said that when Dortmund have something to lose, they tremble. When all is almost lost, they start playing. And there is still something of that about this team. On a tactical level last night, they weren't prepared to, they were prepared to get it launched. And when they did, unlike in previous games, unlike, for example, in the first leg, where Niklas Füllkrug was left up top alone for a lot of the time, they got the ball up to Füllkrug. He was winning headers and he had players running off him. And that's the secret to getting the best out of any target man, really. And one of the players he had running off him who had an outstanding game was Marcel Sabitzer. Played a key role in three of the four goals, setting up two of them and scoring the other. He's really come into his own, particularly in the last few weeks. He scored twice at the weekend against Borussia Mönchengladbach. And actually, every idea that he seems to have going forward seems to be a good one. But for Dortmund to take the setback that they had at the start of the second half when they went from 2-0 up to 2-2 and to then turn it around still is so impressive and symbolic of what, despite the chances that they gave during this game, which were still quite decent, it's still symbolic of what was overall their best performance of the season.
Yeah, you say Sabitzer, everything he did worked, apart from when he took a touch in the second minute and you were like, what are you doing, mate?
Very good point.
Put it away. Yeah, but that start of that game was, start of that game, Jonathan, was amazing. When it, you know, Sabitzer missed the shot, then Morata's through and you're thinking, ah, this is, I mean, this is sort of done if Morata puts this away. And he put it wide and you're thinking, it was just such a brilliant start to this football, mate.
It was a game that I kind of felt, it's a weird leg of that, of the sort of web of the Champions League, that side of it, because I thought Inter would beat Atletico and I thought Atletico would beat Dortmund, and it just seems to be going the complete opposite way. I was really surprised that Inter went out, and I think they are still one of the best teams in Europe, to be honest. But once Atletico made it through, you thought that Dortmund would be a fairly straightforward task for them. But I don't really know what's going on with Atletico Madrid at the moment. I don't know if someone else can give me some insight on that, because they seem to sort of not have that resilience and that solidity that they used to have. And, you know, once they got their noses in front, you thought, nah, Atletico are the sort of team that they can just shut up shop and lock it off. And I was really surprised, even though it is in, you know, a cauldron of noise and a hostile atmosphere, that Dortmund were able to see it through. I mean, was there a sense that kind of the crowd helped them push it forward, Archie? Or I don't know, was there an extra bit of spice that they provided, or was it, what was your thought?
There is that sense at Dortmund on those kind of nights that the crowd can give you that spice. But what surprised me about Atletico is that the elements of the shithousery were there. Whether it was Koke managing to get a handball off Adeyemi for something that he struck into his face, whether it was Jimenez at the start of the second half, after Niklas Füllkrug had won most aerial duels, managing to fall on top of Fulkrug's head, and even Rodrigo Riquelme, like playing this role of what me Gov, after one of the most obvious handballs that you'll see. I was thinking, okay, that's the Atletico I know. But in terms of the peak Atletico in Europe, for me, represented a team where they enjoyed the graft and they seemed to get swallowed up by the occasion. I think that they maybe thought it was done at 2-2. And that was what surprised me, really. Antoine Griezmann was I think isolated in the quality of his performance, because he was still doing the things that he does, but he didn't have, I think, enough support from the players around him. So yeah, Diego Simeone, even at full time, was very gracious with Edin Terzic, because I think he knew, well, we just simply didn't do enough here.
Yeah, I think Atleti have an amazing home record in the Champions League, and I can't remember what it is, but it's something ludicrous. Like, they've, in the knockouts, they just haven't lost, or they've won every single game, but their away form this season is appalling. And you said, you know, I think a lot of people thought when they got it back to 2-2 that would be it. But that goal to put Dortmund 3-2 up, Barry, I mean, that header is absolutely perfect, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not really a glancing header, is it? It's brilliant cross from Sabitzer. Interesting about Sabitzer, playing central midfield for Borussia Dortmund. He scored a goal He had more goals, more assists than he had made tackles in this game. So he, one goal, one assist, didn't make a single tackle. But he seemed to be popping up everywhere. He was all over the shop. It was brilliant. But he blows so hot and cold, you know, you're not going to get a performance like that or anywhere near that out of him on a regular basis. And that's the problem, I think, with Marcel Sabitzer. But anyway, yeah, he puts in this cross and Füllkrug leaps and just steers. And there's a guy leaping with him, but he gets the jump on his marker and just steers the ball into the far corners. Perfect header.
See, I don't want us to fall out, but I have written, it is the definition of the perfect glancing header.
But you see, I think...
is there too much power on
it? We're definitely not going to fall out over it.
okay, that's good.
I think he has to do too much work, like twist his neck and very deliberately steer it. Whereas I think a glancing header, you're just kind of helping it on its way. You don't have to. But I am, you know, I'm not saying I'm right, but that's my opinion.
Archie, how are you classifying this?
I thought it was technically a glancing header.
Right.
It's okay. It's okay.
Jonathan?
I think it comes under the textbook definition of leap like a a salmon, but he leapt.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Leaping like a salmon, I feel like, you know, you think Cristiano Ronaldo and you think sort of heading it back where it came from. That's sort of like, you know, Michael Jordan hanging in the air. Because this was, I think where I kind of agree with you, Baz, is that he's running onto it. And I sense with a glancing header, you're quite often not motionless, but it's a bit more, I see where you're coming from. Yes, Jonathan?
If you think about a salmon leaping, a salmon heading a football doesn't sort of connect with it and bang it, does it?
No.
It glances. If a salmon leapt and hit a football, it would glance. And that was a glance.
And plus, no footballer has ever leapt like a salmon, because if a salmon leaps, it sort of wobbles its lower half of its body. It contorts its body, you know, from side to side.
But that's the sort of way that's the way he jumped. He sort of jumped in a strange way. He sort of jumps in a sort of
But a salmon isn't jumping from a standing start. You know, he's
true.
That is true. And we don't know what's happening under the water.
And we thought Max's introduction to this section was boring.
There's something great about Füllkrug. Here's this guy. He looks quite 1980s League Two. Not all of his teeth. You know, he's sort of a bit of a big lump. And, you know, it's nice that there's one of those in the Champions League semi-final.
He'd been 14 hours without a goal until that header. And to score a goal that was also... it was very aesthetically pleasing because of the curvature of the ball and the way it just kind of nicked in off the post. Whereas with the other goals, you could maybe say about Jan Oblak, could he have done better? Do you think that peak Oblak would have saved them? That was the one where you were like, he has no chance because of just the way it clipped in off the post. Füllkrug has had a difficult time this season. Going back to what I was saying about having enough support around him, I think when he is isolated, you can see that he doesn't have the greatest first touch. But if you play to his strengths, which I think are Dortmund's strengths, i.e. not building up from the back, in a way that they're trying to play through the opposition on the floor, as they were found out by Atleti in the first leg, then I think they're a better side. They're a better side when they go down the wings and they can get a few more balls into Füllkrug. And Edin Terzic said that one of the areas they'd highlighted for Füllkrug before the game was that near post, and he made good on it. And he's going to be in the Germany squad this summer. He'll be behind Kai Havertz, but he is a useful player to have.
Could we have a tip of the hat as well for Ian Mattsson, who I thought was brilliant last night? He's on loan at Borussia Dortmund because Maurizio Pochettino didn't consider him mature enough to play for Chelsea this season. And I thought it was quite telling that he put in a performance like that 24 hours after we'd seen the antics of several players who Poch did consider mature enough to play for Chelsea this season.
Just also a word on Mats Hummels' pass for Julian Brandt's first goal.
Oh, yeah.
Mats Hummels has made a career out of these outside of the boot passes, but even by his standards, that was gravy.
Yeah, it was excellent. I think I credited it to Emre Can. So my apologies, Mats. I definitely credited the own goal to Mats Hummels. My, you know, some old man sticking his leg out. I've done that.
Just want to say one thing about Atletico, though. Like, salmons aside, I do think that they do show signs of an aging team. If you looked at the squad, there's only two players. The starting 11. There's only two players under 29 in that team. Axel Witsel, 35. I agree with Archie as well. You know, Oblak. There's been a lot of criticism in the past few years, and he's not probably the peak Oblak that people know as he was, you know, sort of 5-6 years ago, maybe. Even Griezmann's at 33, and you know, even though he looks maybe like a whippersnapper, but he's, you know, the team feels a bit aging to me. And for an Atleti team to concede 5 goals over 2 legs, that's not very Simeone-like, is it? It's very kind of, I think this is the beginning and the end of that team, really, that Atletico team. I think they're going to need a real regeneration maybe in the summer to sort of go again. And I think that's probably the feeling with Atleti fans.
Right, tonight then, Man City, Real Madrid, Bayern, Arsenal. What's going to happen, Barry?
I don't know, Max.
What do you expect? Who do you expect to progress?
I don't expect anything. I expect 2 good games, but I haven't a clue what's going to happen. I wouldn't have predicted either of those outcomes last night. I don't know, but I'm looking forward to finding out.
All right. Archie, are you on the same page as Barry? No clue? Some hint? I mean, that's what you feel City, especially what they did last year against Real Madrid, when they just, in this first half of that second leg.
It's Real Madrid, Max.
Well, I know it is. I mean, I don't necessarily want City to blow them away, although I'm nervous. I don't know what's happening with the coefficient. I just, you know, it's getting too much. But
do you care about the coefficient?
Well, I care. I care if Tottenham finish fifth, Barry, about the coefficient.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah.
I know that Dortmund qualifying last night was bad news for your English coefficient, Max.
Yes, yeah. But good news for your German coefficient. So, you know, someone's having a happy coefficient.
So it's a privilege to be able to go watch a lot of these games in the stadium. But last Tuesday it was, I got to go around to my mates and watch both of these games on parallel screens, plus Stevenage Barnsley on his laptop.
Good.
Which
on iFollow, excellent. Yeah.
Feels weird pulling for a Steve Evans team, but that's a different matter. They were just so much fun to watch. I'm so excited for both of these games, because I think that I don't think that it suits any of these teams really to sit back that much. Maybe Bayern, probably the most of the four teams.
Yeah. I've heard people say that Bayern won't be allowed to sit back because they're at home, and this has been a problem for Bayern. And actually, you saw against Arsenal, it really suited them. You know, they could play deep and then Kane could spin and play in Sané and Gnabry and whoever. That is how they should play it, right?
Their issue is that Serge Gnabry is out injured, and Kingsley Coman picked up an injury at the weekend against Cologne, meaning that he's out for the season now. So whether Thomas Tuchel trusts Thomas Müller to have the legs to do the running for enough of this game, or whether he'll give someone like Matisse Tell, who he has barely given a start to at all this season, but has impressed, particularly in the first half of the season, off the bench, that is the question there. Bayern do seem on their last legs in terms of injury. This is all they have to play for now. So, yeah, I think that Arsenal will go through, but that therefore makes me think that Bayern will win, because I never trust my first thought.
Case, there's so many English national treasures across Europe at the moment. Bellingham, Teller, Bino Gittins, Rin Tutz, wardrobe consultant. Why can't every pitch side reporter be Archie? Genuinely makes me smile watching his approach and interviews. Football is fun. I don't know if people have watched the highlights of Leverkusen's victory to secure the title more than they've watched you and Jeremy Frimpong having a nice time. But like, how was it? And it is such an extraordinary achievement for Bayer Leverkusen. It is extraordinary that they're unbeaten in all competitions as well. But like, tell us about the day.
That's the thing I really can't get my head around. Unbeaten in all competitions is such a good achievement. Even now, to be 43 games unbeaten is ridiculous. And Sunday was wild, seeing that many Leverkusen fans out and about. even on the street before the game, when I have been to that stadium enough times where they have struggled to fill it. And only this season has that really started to change on a regular basis, let alone the scenes at full time where the fans stayed on the pitch for a good 2 hours after it to wait to see the team emerge from a box at the far end of the stadium and receive the praise and plaudits that they rightfully deserve. And the way that this Xabi Alonso team plays, you spoke on the previous pod about how Ange's plan A maybe doesn't have enough in it. Xabi Alonso's does. It's insane how there are so many facets to it, whether it's the combination play, whether it is the long distance abilities of Grimaldo, Xhaka, Wirtz, the individual quality of Florian Wirtz, or indeed their set pieces designed by Sebastian Parilla. I feel like after the conversation on the last pod as well, I have to name who the set piece coach is now, because we need to give
of
them
course,
a prominence.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it was... It's fun seeing people who don't usually win, because you see them enjoy it on a different level to teams who win all the time. And you just really felt that excitement, and I smelt it as well in a lot of beer-soaked clothing.
Yeah. And, you know, they've gone down very well, those interviews. Like you just have a natural ability to disarm footballers, right?
That I don't think that's for me to say.
Right, all right. No, look, I rarely get compliments too. It's hard to know how to take them, right? Yeah.
This is why I believe that actually the best people to interview after the games are not the goal scorers, because it's an unnatural thing to say, well, you were really good, weren't you? And then to
I'm disappointed I even asked you that question. I don't need to, you know. We're not here to give you praise.
Well, sorry, can I just, on the subject of Archie, I have seen in the past clips of Archie interviewing players and managers going around, and they're having a bit of crack, and it's very entertaining. And I have seen people criticise Archie for, inverted commas, making himself the story. That criticism strikes me as, what sort of a joyless arsehole do you have to be to watch one of those interviews and for that to be your, you know, the opinion you emerge with? And if you watch, for anyone who hasn't seen his interview with Jeremy Frimpong, it looks like, to all intents and purposes, Jeremy Frimpong is like a stand-up comic who's like, and Archie's is the mic stand, and he's kind of leaning against him with his elbow while he talks into the camera and talks to Archie. It's a lovely, lovely moment. Two men, very obviously happy. And it's just terrific. And there is a natural warmth and charm and ability to disarm there. And I've no problem saying it on Archie's behalf.
Yeah. It reminded me of just two blokes getting some air outside a nightclub.
Yeah.
It's a bit noisy in there. Let's just lean on you. I've had a couple too many. Leverkusen aren't universally loved in Germany, right? Because they're, you know, they're big pharma, aren't they? They're a big pharmaceutical company. But is the fact that anyone has stopped Bayern just meant that everyone's happy about it?
Yeah, I think that plays a role, that RB Leipzig exists now and have become a bigger foe for everybody else. And then there's also Xabi Alonso, who oozes class with every statement and gesture, I think, even if David Moyes may not agree with that after he labelled Xavi's bench and that a disgrace after they were all running out to demand a red card last week for Lucas Paqueta during the Europa League game. But just, I think that Xabi Alonso lends himself a lot to improving Leverkusen's image, because he is such a beloved ex-pro as well. And I think that unless you supported a rival team of Xabi Alonso, he's a difficult guy to hate. So yeah, there are some people sniping look, here in Cologne, for example, people in Cologne pretend that they don't recognize Leverkusen as a rival. And yet, on the front page of the main tabloid here, Express, the online version mentioned Leverkusen. The one in the streets did not, because they know that things would have happened to those newspapers, I think.
Is it too early to say, look, is this squad going to get torn apart? You know, or will Bayern bounce back? Or is this the, you know, when's the right time to start asking those questions?
Difficult to know if Bayern are going to bounce back, given how much change has to occur with that squad in the summer, or at least the start of those changes. You've got Max Eberl and Christoph Freund being the architects of that sporting change at Bayern. Plus, they need a new coach. There are noises, but still unconfirmed noises, about them now changing their mind and wanting to go back for Julian Nagelsmann, who is obviously the German national team coach right now. As for Bayer Leverkusen, their CEO, Fernando Caro, has said that they will need to probably sell one big name in the summer. It might well be Jerry Frimpong. It won't be Florian Wirtz, I think, such as the way that he's being managed. Caro has also said that Wirtz will be staying and playing at Leverkusen next season, which I think is a good decision for him. So as it stands, without knowing what at all that Bayern Munich squad's going to look like next season, I think you do make Leverkusen the favourites. Just one more thing I want to mention on Leverkusen. A colleague of mine saw before the penalty that put them ahead on Sunday, saw Michael Ballack get his phone out and start recording. Now, Ballack in 2000 scored an own goal as Leverkusen lost the title on the final day, having been 14 games unbeaten into it, and they only needed a point away at Lowly Unterhaching. But I just love this idea of, I don't know, ex-pros who you think have achieved so much in the game.
Yeah.
And you wonder, what? Surely you're taking your phone out and recording this?
Yeah.
It does kind of make them a little bit more human, actually. I quite liked it.
All right, that'll do for part two. Enough gushing praise for Archie. We'll do Chelsea's victory over Everton in just a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Chelsea 6, Everton 0 on Monday night. Chelsea are ninth, 3 points off sixth place, with a game in hand on everyone and 2 games in hand on West Ham. Everton 16th on 27 points. Forest have 26. Luton have 25 in the relegation zone. I mean, this, Jonathan, was the Cole Palmer show. A perfect hat trick. Like the first goal, that nutmeg, first time finish. The third with his right foot. He is some player, isn't he?
I don't really know what more to say about Cole Palmer, to be honest. I think he along with Foden, I think, are my personal arguable two players of the season. Might be to be decided still, but in terms of a breakout player, although he was obviously quite well known, the impact he's had is incredible. Goes obviously level on the golden boot. Few of those have been penalties, but you still have to score penalties, so I don't think that's kind of like a, you know, the whole non-penalty XG and that kind of thing. You know, you still have to score penalties and he's done that. So fair play to him. And he's had high pressure penalties, which of course, I guess we'll discuss in a minute, the whole debate around that particular penalty against Everton. But I mean, it was a perfect hat trick, right foot, left foot header. The first goal is just disgusting. Like I can't get over it. I could watch it a million times. Firstly, he pretty much ends Branthwaite's chances of going to the Euros like in one foul swoop. Just nutmegs him, see you later, red pen through. I could just vision Southgate's red pen at that exact moment, you know, going through on his notebook. See you later, good luck with your career. Then the sort of flick just to go around the other defender. And the finish is the best part for me. The audacity to just take it first time and bend it around England's number one goalkeeper is just filth. Like, every part of that goal is special, really. And I think he's a special player in that sense, because when you nutmeg someone, it was the perfect balance between trickery and overdoing it. You know, sort of if you nutmeg someone, you're pulling out these tricks and flicks.
Well, it had the end product, right?
To hit it first time, like perfect, like almost like the Masters sort of style, you know, the way he just sort of clipped it in is just peak. It's just technical excellence. The second goal, almost in a way, is a better sign of his just ability, like general ability in that sense of awareness and understanding of football. The timing of the run to get on the head, on the end of the header, the understanding of where the ball might land. That's kind of almost a striker's instinct. And then loves Pickford and then the penalty. So it was a brilliant performance from him. I've enjoyed watching him in more than probably anyone else this season, I think. And he really is superstar quality.
Jonathan mentions the Masters there. And if you look at his third goal from a certain angle, that there is actually draw on it. where Pickford passes the ball, he sends it straight back. And I had to look up the difference between draw and fade. So it is draw right to left as it drops into the goal.
The debate, I guess, now for England fans, Archie, is where does Cole Palmer fit, right? Is he now, if Bellingham isn't having a great game, he goes in the 10? Do you play him? You sort of presume Foden and Saka play wide? Like, is he now above Maddison in the pecking order? Like, you know, he's firmly, surely on the plane, even just for penalties, right?
It's funny. As soon as Jonathan started talking, like, I just very quietly started typing in England squad space. That was because I was thinking, where does he fit? Yeah. And I think he's above James Maddison in terms of ability to pull a game mm-hmm. into his own.
Certainly on form, yeah. Yeah,
orbit. Yeah. I think that Cole Palmer has to be ahead of James Maddison. To be honest, you wonder, going back to Gareth Southgate, if he's putting a red pen through Jared Branthwaite's name, you'd think that given his hatred of pulling up the handbrake, you know, and going off with that, you think, oh, he's probably like, oh no, he's giving me a problem here. I don't want to take an extra attacking player. Yeah. This is a problem. And to be honest, the real problem I think is I just don't trust Jordan Pickford. And there's just having him, for as much as everyone talks about what England have going for them, I think that still defensively, I struggle with being convinced by that. And I think that, yeah, there is a dearth of good goalkeepers in England right now, which is something I always have to hear in Germany, by the way. They are convinced that we've never, ever had a good goalkeeper. And if I'm ever standing in goal and let one go under my foot, then immediately it's like, English are Torhüter. Like,
that's funny. I always presumed our goalkeepers were quite good. You know, like Seaman was quite good, wasn't he?
He's the only English goalkeeper that
the Germans
the people
respect.
On my football team can generally name.
Right, okay.
I remember 5 years ago, I was like, World Cup, who's the English goalkeeper? And they didn't know who Jordan Pickford was. Yeah.
It's interesting that how painful England's defeat on penalties will be when you've got Ivan Toney, Cole Palmer, Harry Kane, you've got all these guys who are like amazingly good at penalties. Nicholas says, who is the designated penalty taker of the pod? You did touch on it, Barry, but that tussle between Madueke and Jackson is absolutely sensational, isn't it? It's not just one person running. It's not like the designated taker and someone else. It's two people who aren't the designated taker. I loved it.
Yeah, it's two people who aren't the designated taker trying to wrestle the ball away from a third person who isn't the designated penalty taker and has no interest in taking the penalty. He's just waiting for Cole Palmer to sort himself out after being poleaxed in the box. It was tremendous fun. Pretty juvenile behaviour from both players, who Madueke and Jackson, who looked like a pair of, you know, spoiled toddlers fighting over a toy. And Barney made an interesting point. It crossed my mind as well, but Barney, as usual, is far more eloquent. He reckons Pochettino probably was pleased that that happened because it meant we all got to see, look, this is what I have to deal with.
It's a really good point. I can't do this anymore. It's like a teacher
getting
home
all
going,
this criticism,
oh,
and look at what I have to deal with. These idiots.
Class 5A. I just absolute shit.
So And the thing is, they were, what, 4-0 up at the time. It doesn't matter. Jackson's already scored a lovely goal where I think three different defenders and Jordan Pickford gave him the freedom of the six-yard box to take the ball down at his leisure, turn and fire home. What did they think? You know, if they score this penalty, is it just to massage their egos / figures, or did they think, oh yeah, that was a routine win for Chelsea? But I thought Cole Palmer was all right, but the way Maduaki struck that penalty for the fifth, that was the highlight of the game for me.
Oh, maybe Todd Bowley has them on some ludicrous goal bonus. Who knows? Alfie Gilchrist looked so happy to score. The fans did as well. A really nice, genuine, one of our own moments, as producer Joel says, that will make selling him as a homegrown player to help profit and sustainability all the sweeter.
Well, maybe they can do like they did with the hotel and just sell them to themselves for a massive...
Yeah, to Chelsea. Exactly. Chelsea have sold Alfie Gilchrist to Chelsea for £100 million. Dan says, regarding the Chelsea-Everton game, I seem to remember Barry often talking about Lampard getting a free ride as Everton manager. If Frank got a free ride, what is Dyche getting? A complimentary ticket for one of those hop-on, hop-off European city bus tours. I mean, they were bleak, Jonathan, in this game, weren't they?
Yeah, pretty drab. And Tarkovsky's interview afterwards was quite interesting. I think he said it was most embarrassed he's felt on a football pitch, which was interesting. I do kind of agree. Well, I think he's, Barry, did you say it was Barney? I do agree with that, actually, because Pochettino made special mention of that at the end, sort of say in his post-match, saying essentially this will never happen again. And it was a bit of a power move from Pochettino at the end of it to kind of call it out and say this is the issues I'm having at this club. I think he specifically said that these are the issues and this is why he wants experience. For Everton, I just kind of feel a bit sorry for Everton at the moment, to be honest. Like, I've been lucky enough to see the new stadium and what's going on there and the efforts they're making behind the scenes. And there's a lot of good people at the club. They do great work in the community as well, Everton. I've obviously been in Liverpool. I've been lucky enough to sort of be around the city and we've had a few trips to Everton and seen a lot of behind the scenes there. The new stadium looks incredible, by the way. And they really are on a precipice of, I think they're in genuine danger of really bad things happening if they were to go down. The whole 7-7 partners thing, the takeover is just a little bit of a gap there in terms of what exactly is going on. And I do think there is a bigger sense of doom than people realise around Everton at the moment in terms of if they were to get relegated. In terms of performance-wise, yeah, they were just shambolic and Cole Palmer destroyed them. But and by the way, Brantford's had a really good season, so I don't want to come across as if I was ridiculing him. He's been in one of England's better young players this season, to be fair to him.
No, it's too late now. We'll edit that bit out. You've killed
it's
him.
I think with them, they're a little bit... The problem I feel with Everton is that Sean Dyche is very good at coaching the team defensively, but they just really lack going forward. When Calvert-Lewin's not there, Beto's okay, but they just... I've seen a couple of their games this season where they really struggle to create anything, and that could end up being their downfall because there's a big few games ahead to come and they need to get some points.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't look amazingly coached defensively.
Not in that game. Right?
In this game, but I take your point. Yes, Archie?
I think the nature of the points deductions that they've had has just slowly eaten away at them. Whereas in the old days, it felt like you got your points deduction and then you could work against that for the season. I think it's difficult as a player when you think you've overcome that hurdle and then it comes and kind of bites you again. But I think that Sean Dyche's the thing that he's done well is actually moderating the noise around that. And that's probably taken up, that's been as much a part of the job as being the actual coach of this club. So I take that into account as well. And it is a very difficult situation to continue trying to motivate players in this sort of atmosphere, and this toxicity that has been there at Everton is deeply ingrained and is not something that I think can be got out quickly. Or at least Sean Dyche has convinced me of that. And that's part of it. You need somebody who is a good communicator as a manager, or that is a bigger part of your job. So, and some coaches don't get that right. So I think it's reflective of that as well.
Everton ledge Neville Southall occasionally hands his Twitter account over to, you know, charities or organisations to use his platform to get their message across. And I think in the past 48 hours, he handed it over to some LGBT organisation. And at the end of it, when it was handed back to him, he said, "I've learnt a lot about the LGBT community. Everton fans, will it bother you if we had the first player to come out? It wouldn't bother me." And a reply from Mike, "It would be good if one of them came out as a footballer at the moment."
It's a good line, isn't it? Their appeal, by the way, the Premier League say they're really going to try and expedite this, you know, get it done before the end of the season. So hopefully we know what the final league table is by the end. We've got an EFL pod next Tuesday, by the way. So Portsmouth fans will be hoping for more than just "well done, Portsmouth." You'll get more on Tuesday, on Wednesday. Correction, yes?
I have a brilliant John Massino stat for that podcast.
Wow, next Wednesday. That's when it is. So,
will it keep till next Wednesday?
I think it'll keep.
I don't want anyone to beat me to it. No, it'll keep.
Okay, fine. But I would say don't hold your breath, because that's quite a long time. Commiserations to Forest Green, relegated from League Two. David got in touch after I suggested Crystal Palace had never had 21 consecutive passes under Roy Hodgson when they scored that goal at Anfield. David said, look, Roy Hodgson Palace team did that against Liverpool, and Andros Townsend Senior scored a brilliant goal. So I stand corrected. Bally says, in the last pod, at 29 minutes and 42 seconds, when Barney Ronay said, "I feel sorry for Kambwala," both me and a friend of mine who were listening independently both heard it as, "I feel sorry for Ken Barlow." So at this moment, would Ken Barlow improve Manchester United's defence? It's a very, very good question. And Matthew says, finally, "I'm going on my stag do to Munich this week. Does Barry have any advice?"
Don't take antibiotics if you have a throat infection. Or if you do... No, actually, that's quite childish advice. Take antibiotics if you have a throat infection, but don't drink on your stag do.
There we are.
If that is the case.
Right. Have a lovely time, Matthew. We wish you all the best. I mean, it'd be good if they dressed him as you, with sort of torrents of shit coming out of your... That was his outfit.
Did you see the stag do? It was doing the rounds on Twitter.
Yes,
Was it in Leeds?
I'm not sure.
A load of... The groom was dressed as a cat and all his mates were Kurt Zuma. And they pitched up outside some cat healthcare or shop, and there was a giant cat outside, a model cat, and they just started kicking lumps out of the cat. It was highly entertaining.
It's good. It's very niche, isn't it? It's very niche. A lot of people would have absolutely no idea. Almost my favorite snag do was someone I know, like, they all had to dress as goths, right? Like proper, you know, DM boots up to the knees, like all in black, makeup, everything. And then they went out in Camden. And obviously, no one batted an eyelid. They were just like, no one gave a shit. Just sitting there, like all self-conscious, and nobody even noticed. Anyway, that'll do for today's pod. Thank you, Archie.
Yes, the ticket prices at Fulham are a disgrace. Thank you, Max.
No, well said. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, Baz.
Thank you.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. Man City, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Arsenal. We'll cover them tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.